if you want to just take a second to introduce yourself to John, and then also feel free to help yourself to fruit and bagels and mimosas and coffee.
Mimosas.
Yeah, honestly, all of the above in that order, whatever you want. And then just naming for myself, I need to go to the bathroom, so I'm going to do that right this moment. And then let's transition into maybe... Let's go to you after that. So,
okay, sounds good.
Good morning. Hi, Monica. I'm a PhD candidate in musicology here at UCLA. And I work on the late 16th century, like recreational singing and the Counter-Reformation, and mostly in Rome. But what I'm looking through books of prayer and kind of looking at the dichotomy of vocal prayer and mental prayer and kind of how the like limits of sound and silence kind of structure belief. And then also kind of like thinking about the acoustic environment of the church. So, yeah, in the beginning stages, but...
Okay.
So that's my relationship to sound, but, yeah.
Very good. Thank
you. Psalters, like psalm books?
Yeah, like Laudes. I guess similar to singing psalms as well. But it's not liturgical at all.
Recreational is what you're saying.
It's like this weird... It's like recreational, but... A lot of secular poetry, but like meant for the church setting, kind of like paraliturgical, I guess.
I went to this one church in, I think it was in Prague when I was visiting, and it was really cool. We just came into this church because it looked like a good tourist stop, and I don't know. My grandparents wanted to see it. And then, like, this little choir of, like, I think Chinese students all came in, and they just started singing, and, like, the whole place just, like, everyone just went silent, and they're, like, singing. It was beautiful to fill the entire space, and I thought, this is what this building's built for. Like, built for the sound.
John, do you have synesthesia?
What a personal question.
I don't, but all of this sounds really wonderful stuff, and I've been jotting notes, and you know, it sets my mind off going in a number of different directions. I'm not sure how much, if at all, any of this is related to that Curiosity Shop paper, but it's all...
Oh, I think it is.
I think it is, yeah.
I was thinking when I was reading it, like, oh, it's too bad that like things are set up so that my my reading comes before the Jason Saskate, because I think it would really be interesting to...
But that's the thing. Now we can bring your reading in and apply those questions we were asking the other day. Because I've been, as a literature person, and I'm sure Chip is in with me, looking forward to the literary moment of our discussion, because our first meeting was so musicology focused, which was perfect because I don't know much about musicology. But then I was like, oh man, like I hope I don't ask a really dumb question. But obviously the point of this is to bring in people who will have different backgrounds and different questions.
We'll ask the dumb questions.
Yeah, but not a dumb question though, because having an outsider read your work is always the best thing for me personally that I can do to make it better.
I mean, what one loose association to everything that you were talking about is to the face opera presentation and deaf studies, which is that the Sunday New York Times every year at the end of the year, or the first issue in any new year, has devotes the magazine section of that book to obituaries of people who died in the previous year. And one of the persons whose obituary is included in that is the woman who was the sign interpreter for the musical group Sweet Honey in the Rock, And Sweet Honey in the Rock is an a cappella African-American group that is interested in labor. It sort of began, rose out of the labor movement and the civil rights movement. And at a certain point, they decided that they wanted to have an ASL interpreter who accompanied them for all their performances. And they hired such a person, but that person proved unsatisfactory. And so they hired another person, the person whose name I'm not going to remember, who worked with them for the rest of her life, and she died in this past year. And the reason that they chose her and were so pleased with her was that she was sensitive to racial issues in a way that the previous ASL interpreter was not. And so that's as much as I can report, but one could go perhaps and investigate and find out more about why her interpretations were more sensitive to racial issues than others were. So that was one very, very loose association. I'm really interested in embodiment and the phenomenology of listening and the phenomenology of sound. And one of the things that we might talk about when Gabe gets back or start talking about now is the taxonomy that I use in that curiosity shop. And on the one hand, I think in some ways it's a useful organizational principle for the paper that I wrote, but I think that the taxonomy is really limited. And so if I were thinking about it, or if I really cared now, I would do a critique of that taxonomy and sort of try and poke holes in it and find out the limitations of that taxonomy. At the same time that I think as a heuristic, just as a useful way of organizing the things that I wanted to talk about, that it worked. But perhaps together we could poke holes in that taxonomy. And one place to begin, and I was interested in the anacoustic chamber?
Anechoic.
The anechoic chamber is the ways in which that forces embodiment and listening upon the experience. I mean, but one place that I would poke a hole in my taxonomy is, and I think Derrida makes the claim that there's no such thing as silence. It does not exist. Because there's always something, even if it's only your heartbeat or whatever. So where do we locate the body in relation to sound? Is it separate from sound? Is it part of sound? Is it a sound-making instrument? Is it making sound at the same time that it's perceiving sound? And Merleau-Ponty and other people like that, I think, who've written on the phenomenology of sensation, would argue that the body doesn't occupy a place either of reception or of, it's not a sound source, but that it participates in both. As I recall the Stephen Feld paper that was assigned, that's one of the things that he as an anthropologist emphasizes. And it's maybe part of the critique of this soundscape notion. I mean, I think soundscape, again, is a useful concept, but one that seems to be based on a kind of binary sort of Cartesian separation of consciousness and phenomena that doesn't really hold true to at least my current thinking about listening as an experience, that somehow embodiment needs to be much more, and that was part of the the critique that you were making of the Baba Kiki thing, mm-hmm. that you that it's the body, it's mm-hmm. the shape of the mouth that is that lies behind what seems to be at least some of that claim to universal sounds, that the nature of the tongue has to be taken, the shape of the tongue, the shape of the mouth. So we started talking
I assumed
about
you
different
would.
Stuff.
Yeah, no, I assumed you would. It's just fine.
Mm-hmm. So what else was I thinking? Oh, I was thinking about, this is just a string of loose associations to the stuff that I heard you talk about. I was thinking about, and I can't think, it's Mary Douglas, isn't it, the anthropologist who writes about purity and danger? Is that the title of it, Chip? Purity and...
Yeah, purity and danger, yeah.
Yeah, and anyway, she talks about dirt, and dirt is matter out of place.
Mm.
That dirt isn't necessarily it's a cultural definition of what defines whether it's good or bad. That dirt is simply matter that's not in its proper place. I was thinking, does that apply to noise?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Is noise just sound that's out of place that you don't want to treat as a signal or as a sign? It's something that you want to and the concept of white noise. What is white noise? I mean, why is it? What's the whiteness of? I mean, all noise might be white or maybe black, depending on how you want to value what white and white.
Just to agree with you, there's a poet, and I can pull up his name because I have it in my notes, and he says, noise is just sound that nobody wants.
Yeah, exactly.
And he puts it so beautifully in a kind of, I've seen him perform this piece about noise, and that's a line that just strikes me. So I'll pull up his name for you.
Oh, yeah.
It'll take me a second, but I can do it.
I was going to say about the white noise, like, I remember I was doing a psychology program in my undergrad, and so I was learning about vision and how people perceive color and how light combines and makes white light, and then I was concurrently taking this sort of intro physics type class where we're talking at one point about white noise and how it's a combination of all these sounds, and I was like, oh, this is so beautiful, that there's like a sort of cross-perceptual description of just a combining of things. And so to me, the idea of white noise is really a beautiful concept of like all the sounds coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that like, you can have white light and then you can take a prism and you can break it apart again.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, I find it to be a very beautiful description. But I think that's really interesting to think about how dirt is matter out of place and maybe noise is sound out of place, because there's nothing inherently wrong with a sound, but some people will find it, disruptive or even painful if they have like misophonia, which we were also talking about yesterday. It could just be described as out of place.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my wife is a therapist, and in her profession, she doesn't use those white noise machines, but in the psychotherapy world, white noise is the little machine that use to make a sound, keep other noises from intruding on the therapy session. And so white noise is a barrier to what I guess Murray Schafer would call signal. That signal is something that stands out, that communicates, and white noise is what blocks other signals from intruding on the signal that you want to hear. But the idea of white noise as beautiful, as aesthetically, as the combination of all possible sounds.
What you were just saying reminded me too of the Douglas writing and how it was sort of described in like the description of the screams during which critique, the second critique author name?
Cydia Hartman?
No, the second one.
Oh, Fred Moten.
Moten was talking about how with the screams, you know, possibly there's some meaning that's being disguised by this noise, and it's not meant for certain people's ears. So, yeah, that's another use of a possible use of noise as a way to block out the signal.
Yeah, I Gabe, when Gabe talked about the about non-normative language, sound that is not in normative language, I thought that's what a scream is. That's thing, and I'm interested in, there's even a little bit in my Curiosity Shop paper.
Yeah.
About sounds that are not in normative language, and
but we can even extrapolate that to things like accent, right, or dialect, where the Cockney accent is noisy because it's not normative to Queen's English.
Right. Yeah.
The poet's name is Aaron Swinster, Z W I N T S C H E R.
Wow, can you do that one more time?
Yeah. Sorry, that
is
was.
Is it E R A N?
A-A-R-O-N.
Okay.
Zwinscher, Z-W-I-N-T-S-C-H-E-R. And the performance, and I saw it performed live, I don't know if there's a video or anything, but it's called Past the Point of Silence.
And what was the name of the Dirt is Matter Out of Place?
What was that?
Mary Douglas.
Mary Douglas, thank you.
Famous anthropologist.
Yeah.
Past the Point of Silence, is that?
Oh, double check, yes. Past the Point of Silence.
Will you add that to the book now?
Yes. So you said, sorry, Mary Douglas, and we'll add Aaron.
Purity and Danger, I think, is the
okay.
title of the book. So anyway, that was just a bunch of loose associations. I want to go in the anechoic room before it gets taken down.
Yeah.
Somebody said yesterday, there's a paper to write there because it's about to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. I feel the urge to do it, but I have to go back to Berkeley. But Irv was so interesting.
Yeah.
Irv deserves like a New Yorker profile or something, you know, like he's just this person who has been watching sound studies change so dramatically alongside technology over the past, you know, 40 years or however long it's been. I just, that wealth of knowledge and of now completely obsolete knowledge of all of these machines that were the next big thing for 5 seconds and then superseded by the next machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was pretty excited to show off this Jamrit test. It felt like very few people ever asked him about it.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, good, you're interested in this chamber.
Yeah.
Let me tell you all about this chamber.
He has all the answers you could ever want about that.
Are you interested in these old computers?
Well, he must have loved it that this seminar existed
and you came to visit him.
Yeah.
I think so.
It
was
a good experience.
It was pretty special.
It was really special.
Yeah.
But maybe I should talk a little bit about my Curiosity Shop paper and then get your reactions to it. And a couple of things I can tell you are, one is that the first version of this paper was a conference paper in 2003. And it didn't get finished and into print until 2015. So why? One question is why did it take 12 years to get from its first version into, aside from just laziness and other tasks. So we could maybe talk about that. But the reason that I know that the first version was 2003 is that that's the year when John Picker wrote the book called Victorian Soundscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And Picker has a chapter on Dickens in that book. It's the first sound studies, Victorianist sound studies book that was ever written. And Picker has one, I don't think the chapter on Dickens is is all that useful to me, except in this one brilliant thing that he does, which is to identify that Babbage reference in Dombey and Son. And Dickens was friends with Charles Babbage, the mathematician, philosopher, guy who invented the computer, as they claim, a difference machine that was the ancestor of the modern computer. And Babbage had that sort of wacky theory of sound that the atmosphere was a giant recording machine, and that every sound ever made, every word ever spoken, is somehow imprinted on the molecules of the air, and that under certain conditions, those sounds could be retrieved. And I thought that's just a wonderful concept. And it has a kind of religious analog, which is that everything that ever happened, every sound ever made, is recorded in God, in some spiritual location. But this is a secular version of that. And so I thought, of course Dickens is interested in this, because it's so spooky. It's you know, that all of that stuff is somehow retrievable. And so what I wanted to do was to find other evidence in Dickens, not just that one specific reference, that Dickens was interested in what I eventually came to call uncanny sound. And so out of uncanny sound, I said, okay, I'm looking for uncanny sound. What is uncanny sound? Uncanny sound is spooky sound that doesn't come from an identifiable source. So in order to identify uncanny sound, you've got to distinguish it from identifiable sources. So that's when I came up with the simplistic taxonomy. So the taxonomy said there are five kinds of sound, and I said five kinds of sound in Dickens, in literature, in existence. There are five kinds of sounds. I've got a great grandiose theory of sound, which I don't think is true. But so either they're natural sounds, or they're mechanical sounds, or there's voice, or there's uncanny sounds, or there's silence. Those were my five categories. And as I said a while ago, I think we can poke holes in that taxonomy, but it still seems to me a useful way to. So then I started, and I picked the old Curiosity Shop because, as the ones of you who've been to a Dickens universe know, every year that conference focuses on a single book. And so I was giving a paper on the old Curiosity Shop. I said, I'll look for sound in the old Curiosity Shop. And so when you go through a literary text looking for sounds, you find a bunch of sounds. So I marked every passage, and it turned out there were a bunch of weird sounds in the old Curiosity Shop. Again, I wasn't surprised. So I tried to classify them, and I did. And I found a bunch of passages, and it was sort of an excuse to read certain passages and say, here's how sound I think is working in this particular context, rather than to come up with some grand theory of how sound always works in Dickens. But one of my favorite passages that I found was that description of the character whose name is Samson Brass, who's a lawyer, who always has his tongue at his fingertips. Mm-hmm. And I thought the idea of having your tongue at your fingertips is just absolutely wonderful, because that's a displacement of the organ of articulate speech, of articulation, mm-hmm. to a different part of the body. Again, the body, or the notion of embodiment connected to sound. Yeah, and I thought that's what we do every time we sit down at the computer, is to displace voice into our fingertips, or into the quill pen that Dickens is writing with. And I thought, of course, that's why Dickens loves this weird metaphor of the tongue at your fingertips. And then another place that I really liked that I discovered when I did my, you know, markup passages that have to do with sound is the passage that, well, there are two passages in the section of the paper that deals with travel, the sounds of travel. I said in mechanical, there's the sounds of popular culture, which is a bunch of music stuff, and then there's in industry and urban experience, the sounds of the city and the sounds of the Industrial Revolution, and those were pretty straightforward. But the sounds of travel, there were two passages that were, most of the travel in this novel is unpleasant. Mm. It's difficult, arduous, and but there are these two passages that were pleasant travel, where Nell, the protagonist, is inside a wagon, in both cases, Mrs. Jarley's caravan, and when it starts moving, there are a bunch of sounds, and one of the sounds is the double knock of the brass knocker. And I said, that's the heartbeat. And I love thinking about that experience of being inside where visual sensation is limited and auditory experience is enhanced as a result of the limitation of the visual. And I said, that's the experience of the infant in the uterus, in the womb, and where there is no sight, or so far as we know, we don't have very many reports on that experience, but where the heartbeat is vital, and is the heartbeat inside or outside for the infant in the womb? Or is it both? Or where is the body in relation to sound for the infant in the uterus? I think there isn't a distinction between inside and outside. So if you were to identify the sound source, how would you do it? And the whole taxonomy is sort of based on identifying sound sources in relation to the perceiver. But if you do a kind of Stephen Feld phenomenology of sound, the body is in an in-between state. It's both inside and outside. And then the other passage of travel is an extended description of sound inside a wagon. And I think it's doing a similar kind of thing of limiting the field of vision and amplifying sound and creating a kind of blessed unity of sound where sound is inside and outside and experienced through vibrations. And that's one of the things that the anechoic chamber does is to emphasize vibration, that sound is not something that's perceived through the ear alone, the isolation of sensation. And you were talking, Gabe, about that as well, that we tend to isolate the senses. And synesthesia is a blending or a merging of different sensations. And what happens when you, I mean, I think back to John Locke and the whole empirical tradition where Locke distinguishes between primary qualities and secondary qualities, and primary qualities are vision and touch, and so number, size, shape, things that you can feel with your hands or that you can see with your eyes, and those are primary, and secondary are smell, taste, and sound, and those are somehow inferior. But what happens when you isolate or block out one of the senses and you're dependent, and you know, deafness seems to me to do that. Deafness, when you gain deafness, what you're doing is blocking out one of the sources of sensation, and that requires an enhancement or amplification of the other senses. And those are useful experiences to enable us to study the way that, that sound or any sense operates is by arbitrarily isolating one. So anyway, what all of this was really designed to do for me in setting the old curiosity shop was to be able to talk about uncanny sound. And uncanny sound is sound that either merges the other, some of the others, or comes from a source that you can't figure out. And there I was thinking, it's funny that you mentioned Todorov, because Todorov, the French, I think he's originally Bulgarian, structuralist, I think his first book, or anyway, one of his earliest books was on the fantastic and, as a literary mode. And he uses a very simple taxonomy or paradigm to define the fantastic. And so in spooky stories, either the ghost turns out to have an empirical source, or it's a real ghost. But there's some cases where you can't tell whether it has a rational empirical source or whether it's really some supernatural thing if you accept that such things exist. And in that intermediate zone where it's neither rationally empirically explained or supernaturally explained, you have this zone called the fantastic. So I thought uncanny sound is the fantastic of sound. It's that intermediate. So I started looking for instances in Curiosity Shop of uncanny sound or fantastic sound, you could have called it. And what I was really looking for was those Babbage moments where you get what Dickens in other places calls ghosts of sound. And I thought the model for this is the echo. I mean, the echo can be rationally explained or scientifically explained. But echoes are, in another sort of frame of reference, ghosts of sound. And that fits with the Babbage theory about the molecules. And if there were some way that you could, you know, Babbage doesn't have a playback system in his theory. It's sort of random. Under the right circumstances, maybe a sound from the 16th century will come back to us, but you can't predict or produce. There's no button you can push in order to get those. But maybe if you're in the right place, in the right church at the right moment, you'll get that sound coming back to you. So I looked for and then claimed to find some moments of uncanny sound in Curiosity Shop. So that was the argument of the paper. Mm-hmm. And I'll stop at this point.
I just wanted to ask, I think that's really fascinating, especially with all this uncanny sound, because I'm doing research with like machine versus human speech, and there's definitely a lot of times where I think about the uncanny valley of what it is, how, what that intermediate zone is, and when people find it difficult to discern a machine from human. And so I was just wondering, when I was reading about your taxonomy and the description of the different types of sounds, I found it really interesting to sort of reconceptualize how you have natural sounds that are non-human, but are created by a natural or non-man-made environment, and mechanical sounds, which are sort of the result of man-made creations. And then there's, of course, human speech, and that uncanny sound is could overlap a little bit with mechanical sounds in a way, because it could be produced by something that's man-made, like a chair. You know, it's kind of a man-made object, but it still doesn't make sense that it has a voice. And I think too, in like modern machines, where you have like robots that sort of take on a life of their own. It kind of feels like they stop being man-made at a certain point, but they are kind of possessing their own space. And people treat machines with like weird degrees of respect that you wouldn't give to a computer or laptop type mm-hmm. thing. So I think it's interesting to maybe talk about that overlap and how, like, what exactly the uncanny is. I think that's really, really interesting. So, mm-hmm. I don't know if I have a specific question, but I definitely want to talk more about that. Cause it's really
yeah,
cool.
Well, I mean, my idea about uncanny sound was that either the source is unidentifiable, or it's the result of a blending of two of the other categories.
Uh-huh.
So something that is both mechanical and human would, in my taxonomy, qualify as uncanny. So a talking chair, it combines voice and machine. So that I'm not sure that that's all that useful. But let me give you some other examples. And I have a little story to tell. One other story I remember. What is a wind chime? Mm-hmm. Is a wind chime natural or mechanical?
I would say, well, if we're going by man-made, is the definition mechanical?
But the wind is the agent that produces the sound.
Uh-huh. I just want to like scream Aeolian harp at everybody.
It's
but
Aeolian
I
harp. It's,
yeah.
I was thinking about Aeolian harp.
Yeah.
You could scream that. I wouldn't know what you were talking about. So like
a 19th and probably early 18th century instrument that is placed in the window and the wind blows through it. And so the Romantic poets, you know, write about this harp as a force of nature because you hear nature's music through it.
And that's also a metaphor for the poet, the poetic imagination, that the poet is
the
simply...
The poet is the Aeolian harp.
Is the Aeolian harp that's hanging herself out in the window and natural beauty flies through
yeah.
the imagination. And produces music, and that's poetry.
And this goes back so much to what you were saying about Dickens's metaphors. If you are a writer and you're thinking that your tongue is next to your hands and mm-hmm. all of that, there is that, but there's also such a rich history of, yeah, the Romantic poets saying that they are just the medium through which the poetry makes its way into the world. And then in, you know, 19th century media technologies, you do get, you know, typewriter women who are just thought of as these bodies through which the male genius idea is transcribed, or, you know, telegraph operators. So there's so much richness happening. And just while I have the floor, I want to make a reading suggestion, because you're talking about Babbage's theory of sound. And there's a 1916 short story by Friedlander, and I can put it on our bibliography, but it's called, I think, Goethe and the Phonograph, or Goethe Speaks into the Phonograph, and it takes the creation of the phonograph and also the big historical connection between the building of the phonograph, modeling after the human ear, and what it does in this short story is theorizes that if all the sound in the universe is material and exists forever, and if things like the gramophone exist and are able to record sound, that surely you could reverse engineer that technology and suck all the sound back mm-hmm. down and then play back something from the past. And so in this short story, they build this machine and they take it to Goethe's study and they're able to suck up the voice of Goethe from where he used to hang out and like hear these conversations so that they can know the voice of Goethe, even though he was not alive in a time when you could actually record his voice. So that's a very fun story. It's in the German media theorist Kittler's book, Gramophone mm-hmm. Film Typewriter, which is also, like, I think, a speaking point in this Victorian and literary and 19th century sound studies perspective. So. Mm-hmm. I feel like many of us would get a kick out of that short story.
Yeah, that's great. I want to get the reference.
yes.
One thing that I I still like very much about the paper that I wrote on Curiosity Shop is the part where I talk about Master Humphrey. And if you haven't read the old Curiosity Shop, you don't really understand who Master Humphrey is. But Master Humphrey is the narrator of the first three chapters of the old Curiosity Shop. And then in a very strange formal shift in the narration, Master Humphrey drops out and a third person non-character voice takes over the narration for the rest of the book. It's a very awkward moment. And the reasons for doing this are pretty clear, that you can't have a first-person narrator tell things without that first person being present to observe them. So the requirements of the story that Dickens wanted to tell meant that he had to shift to a third person, what we call a third person narrator. But Master Humphrey, in an earlier section of the what's called Master Humphrey's Clock that precedes the old Curiosity Shop, again, that's a complicated story to explain, talks about the house where he lives, and he lives in this old house where there are ghosts of sound. And he describes the house, and I said, this is a description of the human ear. He lives inside a giant artificial ear, and it's a recording studio he's living in, where because of all the nooks and crannies and corridors and everything, he's living inside that thing that Babbage couldn't quite theorize, which is the playback machine. He's living inside something that has trapped all the sounds that took place within that environment. And so I really like that little moment in my reading of the text. But the story I wanted to tell is about going to the Museum of Modern Art exhibit in San Francisco called Soundtracks. And there was a room in that exhibit. It was a very interesting exhibit, but with all sorts of sound devices and synesthesia experiments. But there was one room, the one that stood out most for me in my experience, and there were two exhibits in one large room. One was a large pool, about 30 feet in diameter, in which there were porcelain bowls placed.
You remember the
exhibit? I mean, I don't have to describe it.
Yeah, we went after the meeting.
I did not go to the exhibit, but a lot of people did.
Yeah, but maybe describing it would also help.
Make sure of that point.
Okay,
and, that's great. And there was some kind of motor set up to create a little ripple effect. Mm-hmm. So the bowls, the porcelain bowls, beautiful bowls, you know, of different diameters, circular bowls, were floating around in the pool, and they would bump into each other randomly. And when they bumped into each other, they made a sound. And it was aesthetically beautiful in many ways, because visually it was appealing, the sounds, the randomness, all of this. So I thought about this in relation to my taxonomy. Is this mechanical or is this natural? And of course it's mechanical, because there's a motor set up to create the ripple effect. But
this was just a video that I saw.
Chip, we can send you a link to it so you can check it out later.
Yeah.
You guys saw it. So.
Yeah. It's very nice. I like it.
Yeah. So,
you're saying it was mechanical or?
Is it mechanical or is it natural?
Ah, right.
So, in order to make the argument that it's a natural sound, you have to make some substitutions and imagine a real lake and not porcelain bowls, but other objects that bump into each other that are natural objects and that make a sound. So you could argue that this is a me- a reproduction of a natural sound environment where the flow of gravity produces motion, and that there are objects floating in that bump into each other and that make a sound. That would be the argument that it's natural, but obviously the museum environment makes it mechanical. But the real thing I wanted to get to is that there's another exhibit in the same room. And the other exhibit in the same room is a chair, a single chair sitting in isolation. And it's easy to miss because you might not realize that the chair is an exhibit. You might think that the chair is a place to sit to observe the pool. Mm-hmm. But if you go and sit down on the chair, you realize that the chair is an exhibit, that it's a soundtrack exhibit. Mm-hmm. And when you sit on the chair, it turns out that the chair is wired electrically. And when you sit on it, you activate something that creates the sounds of digestion. So your own body is making the sound, or it's reproducing the sounds of. Here's the thought I had, again, questioning my taxonomy. It's a kind of whoopee cushion, right, effect that you sit on, and it farts, it makes a sound. Is this a mechanical sound or a natural sound? When your belly growls or rumbles, when your heart beats, is that a natural sound or is it a human sound?
I love the uncanny piece, and I have lots of other questions that you've touched on, like things I want to talk about in more depth. But specifically this line of question, I think it's worth kind of working with the kind of, there's a multitude of eco-critical thought around these distinctions, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of stuff in literary Marxism with Raymond Williams and Henri Lefebvre, thinking about nature as a constructed space. Mm-hmm. Anne Birmingham, I think, is maybe a more literary example of that, thinking about conceptions of nature in British literature and art being, aesthetic construction. And so those distinctions if we were to take into account, where eco-criticism has brought us, and we're at a place where, like, nature can't exist without that touching against human activity. I mean, not just at the scale of the Anthropocene, but even just our, there is almost never a moment when we can conveniently make a distinction between a kind of event that is where nature and where the relationship between nature and human agency is ambiguous, that doesn't hold some space for both. Either because anything humans produce also is of the natural world. There's not a simple distinction that makes humans not natural.
Yeah.
And our actions are natural.
I often have that question about, like, is this man-made? Is this natural? If it's like an anthill and ants created this, we're being very human-centric and thinking mm-hmm. about things divided between mechanical and natural.
And then conversely, in the instance of those artworks, I think what's most compelling is that part of what gives them their power as artworks is that they occupy this ambiguity. And I kept on thinking about disequilibrium from yesterday. So as being another way of thinking about this, like this place where we're unsettled because we don't know, mm-hmm. And that not knowing is effectively a really powerful place. And so even asking those questions is a move towards resolving that discomfort that comes from the disequilibrium. And so, even taking something more uncanny, like I was thinking about the in The Count of Monte Cristo, when he's in prison and he's hearing the voice of another prisoner and he can't ever really be sure if it's a real person or not. I'm pretty sure that's the instance. Does anyone else read The Contemplative Essay?
Yeah, I love that. It's like a book.
It's my favorite novel of all time. It's 200 pages of something awful, and then 1,000 pages of revenge.
It's a wonderful book. I recommend it. Yeah.
Likewise. But so there is this instance where the protagonist is in prison, and he hears the voice of another prisoner, and he's deeply disturbed by the voice because it's uncanny, because he doesn't know if this is a real voice, if he's going crazy, or if he can trust the voice, even if it is a real voice, is it actually a tormentor, or is it a you know? And I think that state that you're describing is wonderful, and for me, other than the kind of pure pleasure of philosophy, I don't know that I want to think about whether or not wind chimes are an operation of the wind or operation of human endeavor. Mm-hmm. I would rather appreciate that what makes them consistently magical in spite of our aesthetic judgments is that they hold that ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really potent thing to consider in sound.
Mm-hmm. That kind of brings me to what I wanted to mention as soon as the bowls came up, right? And it's like, are these bowls at the MoMA this or that? And to me, a simple answer that we can then play with is, well, certainly art is a taxonomical category that can help us with this because, you know, Alexander Pope is trying to figure out, like, nature versus art, right? Like, the source and test and end of art is nature and vice versa. And there's this long history in, I think, literary and philosophical experience and musical experience and poetic experience of trying to figure out something like an alien harp or like an exhibit at the MoMA. And I agree that I don't want to add more taxonomical categories because I sort of want to actually just explode all the taxonomical categories. But at the same time, thinking of art as a way of thinking of something that is man-made but also might be somewhat natural, might be mechanical, especially with certain types of art installations, they are using mechanisms and machines, technologies. Just kind of wanted to throw that in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, just to be the token psychology person here again, it sort of ties back into the nature-nurture question of man or human or whatever as well, where, you know, is a person a product of their environment or of their genes? And a lot of psychological research has sort of come to this uncomfortable finding that very little of what people do is a conscious, like, determined action, that a lot of it comes from prior training. Even in neuroscience studies, no one can prove that free will exists, and that makes a lot of people studying humans sort of uncomfortable because most people want free will to exist. And so maybe there's this question too of, like, are things man-made just purely natural if man doesn't have an actual will, doesn't have an actual ability to affect the environment in any way that the environment hasn't already affected them? So just throwing that out there too. It's not necessarily a point that I just think it's interesting to throw out there to add to the discussion.
It's good to bring in too, because I was just at it was funny, one of you mentioned a panel you were just at the other day, or maybe it was a Q&A person. I was just at a panel on musicality. Someone was just at a panel on virtuosity. But I was just at a panel on musicality at UC Riverside. And I asked a question because the speaker was talking about Persian poetry and the kind of interrelationship between British Romantic poetry and these mm-hmm. Persian poets. And I was like, okay, well, you know, the Romantics are really interested in natural sounds, birds, you know, et cetera. Are the Persian poets as well? And something that she mentioned was that the Persian poets were aware, so they would often write their poetry in the garden, but they were aware that the garden was a man-made, constructed space, and therefore the birds in the garden were sometimes incorporated into the poetry, but in that conception of natural, like, the poets seemed to be aware that it was influenced by human creation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember why that seemed really relevant when I started saying it, but it did.
I mean, it's holding the contradiction in place and not being discouraged by it in some
yes.
way.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, which I think is valuable also in engaging those particular artworks, not to be overly concerned about the truth of the artwork in terms of its mechanics, you know, and because I think what makes those artworks effective is the affect, is the experience of it, and to kind of, and this is I think maybe one of the ways that people often try to negotiate discomfort of not knowing, and this happens in art. I see this happening in art a lot. Is trying to understand it on an empirical level, on a mechanical level. Well, what actually made this work? What is the mechanics of it? How does it work? What is the function of it? And this real anxiety about being caught up in the magic of it or the illusion of it. And that's actually, artists have that problem too. Like, they don't want to be fooling anybody or tricking anybody. Not all artists, but some artists are really concerned about that from an ethical position. And so maybe to bring it back to Dickens, I mean, I'm interested to what extent, you know, when he produced uncanny figures in his work, he wanted people to deduce what it was in reality, or if he took a particular pleasure or had a particular purpose for wanting that to retain its ambiguity. You know, so like that passage about Master Humphrey's house, I mean, does he want people to believe it literally, that it contained all these things, or did he trust that people would either A, ascribe its supernatural existence if it they wanted to, or, you know, understand it as pure metaphor? That's a question.
And I think he wants to leave it ambiguous. I think he wants to have it both ways. And the concept of the uncanny sound is a way of marking those experiences that don't reduce to an explanation, either empirical or supernatural. But the question that I have is, does, since there's so many ways in which the taxonomy collapses at various points along the continuum, does uncanny lose its value as a concept?
I don't think so. I think it's good.
I like it. I want to hold on to it.
Yeah.
But,
hey, Chip, I just know you've been quiet, and I wanted to make sure that you feel welcome to jump in.
Oh, thank you. No, I was just about to. It's, the microphone is still cutting in and out, so I'm like still trying to track the conversation.
Okay.
But I think John just mentioned the question of if the uncanny still holds up as a concept. Did
yeah.
Did I hear that right?
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about that as I read that piece, because for me, or in the Freudian sense of the uncanny, right, it's a kind of slight discrepancy, or it's a lag, or it's a kind of straying away from the familiar, right, the Heimlich. And so I wonder then if maybe these uncanny sounds in the soundscape of Dickens are sounds that we would otherwise be familiar with, acquainted with, in proximity to, but then also slightly different, right? We hear it from a source we don't expect it to hear, like a talking chair or a talking clock. It's muffled, it's obscured, it's a convergence of different things. So it seems as if there's a distortion here that's happening in the Dickensian soundscape that I wonder if we might talk about a little bit as well.
It's a different kind of distortion or acousmatic question, though, than the one from the voice, because, I mean, I originally thought of, like, your back is turned and you're trying to hear something, and then you're making all sorts of adjustments, but those aren't necessarily uncanny sounds. I mean...
they're uncanny when they're coming out of a body you don't expect them to be,
yeah,
in that sense.
I think there's something there. I just... it's a different... I think the uncanny does work here that... that's different than the acousmatic question that we were talking about with the voice yesterday. We're talking about, like, the supernatural and the non-historical or something like that, and something that has to do with the fantastic, and that's a different kind of uncanniness than making sort of presumptions about racialized voices.
Yeah, well, and that's such a good point, because I wonder, what is it then about the voice and its relationship to subjectivity or persona or personality or character? What is it then about this kind of separating between the voice and the utterer of the voice? why is that so terrifying or fantastic for certain people? It seems as if, you know, at least in the text we've been looking at, Dickens and Douglas are both especially interested in what happens when a normally humanized voice is dismembered from the source of it, right? Like, why is that so...
panic. There's a panic. There's a panic, right?
Precisely,
And that you see that on the faces of the judges in the voice. and you see it on the... You see a different kind of panic on Adam Levine's face. And even on the token black judge, there were two different. There was Usher and there was Jennifer Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer Hudson, and we talked about this, right? Jennifer Hudson's reaction was a different kind of performance of panic than Usher, who like pretended like nothing was going on or tried to pretend. It was kind of funny to see him like.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to be...
Well,
sorry, there's like a second and a half lag as well. So when I started talking, it's because the sound made it seem as if you were done. Sorry, I apologize. That makes me think about, like, in late 19th century, early 20th century American literature, the whole rhetoric of passing, right? And if passing is usually understood as a kind of visual iconography or a visual index of someone's racial identity, I wonder how sound then also complicates that. And let's say the case of the voice, it seems as if we rely on, you know, notions of, say, skin color or skin type as a way to deduce racial identity. But I wonder if voice is somehow a way to complicate that as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Listening on the radio, like, oh, this person sounds like they have a black voice, or even the kind of debate over, say, authenticity in soul music. What does it mean if a white singer taps into a racialized market like that, or a racialized genre?
I mean, this is Jennifer Lynn Stover's concern in The Sonic Colorlined, is that, you know, through their mediums where we hear a voice without seeing the body, and know or presume to know something about race through that, and she uses she uses radio and sound recordings as you know circumstance like particular artists and performances as moments to illustrate our ability to identify race through sound and in specific through voice, but two to also mistake race, or be confused, or problematized by race, or by the voice, by the timbre, by the qualities of those voices. So yeah, I mean, those questions, if those are interesting questions, The Sonic Color Line is a good place to look. Beginning.
I was just thinking something like actually Nina talked about in like a different version of the paper we heard.
Nina's the one who presented on the voice.
Talking about this like acousmatic question, because in a way it's like very formalist, but allows us to talk about like. I don't know, racial anxieties in the United States and how that's very situated, even in the voice. But it was like something like you hear a voice and it's sort of like you ask the question or you make an assumption like, oh, that must be a black woman. And so it's like, okay, there's one. And then you realize who it actually is and that's one. But one plus one never equals two. It's always sort of one plus one plus one plus one because there's so many layers to that relationship. It's almost like into infinity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. And this is like my really loose connection to then going back to the uncanny because I kept thinking about the ghost in the machine idea, like coming out of like Cartesian dualism. And I always think about this it happens a lot in opera, like there'll be a disembodied voice off stage. It's kind of like what encapsulates the fantastical with organ playing, like there's someone up there that is doing mechanics, but they are human, but then there's all this air going through this massive machine, and it's, I think there's an essay out there somewhere about this idea of, like, the organ is, like, the ghost in the machine, kind of, like, par excellence or something.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, like, one plus one plus one thing where we can't fully encapsulate all of it in a moment, and I think there's something, it's tenuous, but I think there's something related to the uncanny, it's just more maybe politicized. But in terms of the uncanny, I think there's something to me about getting back to the actual raw ontology of sound, like thinking about the alien harp or the bowls. It is this like materialist thing, and it is also this very natural thing at once. But for me, or this is the thought that I had, I think there's something there about how it resembles how we think consciousness works, and when, this is kind of all over the place. There's this idea eliminated materialism, how I think philosophers and neuroscientists actually think about consciousness. So, is it highly material, or is there something else there? Is there a soul that goes on?
Right.
Kind of like, is there color or not? Like, does color exist? is there this qualia, like, outside of the wiring of the brain? And I was like, it's kind of like with a wind chime. It's like there's the wiring of the brain, there's the hard metal, there's all the mechanics there, but you need the wind to sort of come through and get it to create sound. So I was thinking, like, with the uncanny, and I've kind of thought about this with opera a bit, when the outside source, or maybe in Dickens' novels, when it's coming from a different source you don't expect, if it's not behaving the way you expect consciousness to line up with materialism and metaphysicalism, or whatever you want to call it, it's that's sort of what makes it uncanny. It is bringing together those two, it is kind of crushing those two things together. So I think there's a relationship between consciousness itself as, like, mimetic and actual consciousness to uncanny sound. If that makes any sense at all.
I kind of wanted to bring this back again.
Or it's just cognitive dissonance.
I don't know. I just kind of wanted to bring this back again to the idea of, like, you know, dirt as what was it?
Matter out of place.
Matter out of place, and noise as maybe sound out of place, and I think that in a way, uncanny is kind of an example again of something that's out of place, like. You know, you don't expect a voice to be coming out of a chair, or you maybe you could call it uncanny if you think that a white person shouldn't be able to produce sounds like that. But that's sort of an uncanny. It sort of puts you in a state of dissonance.
Hey.
So yeah. I don't know. I think this out of placeness is something that's interesting to talk about too.
Chip. Of course, correctly referred to Freud. I mean, the term uncanny, unheimlich, means unfamiliar, unhomelike, unfamiliar in that sense. And so the uncanniness, I could have used fantastic there, but I chose uncanny because of the Freudian connection. And I think that what we're talking about is this dislocation. And I tried to get at that in my paper a little bit by talking about the displacement of voice, that in the theatrical entrance where a voice precedes the appearance of a character on stage means that there's a sound, but the source is not readily identifiable. And in the in the old curiosity shop, the concluding example that I tried to kind of build toward was the sound that the grandfather makes at the time of the death of little Nell. And he's making a sound that is experienced by the listeners as unearthly. That's the word that is used, an unearthly sound. And because the novel was originally published in serial installments, the serial installment ends before the source of the sound is identified. So you hear an unearthly sound, and then you have to wait a week before you find out what the source of the sound is. And then you find out that it's coming from grandfather. But it still is unearthly, because it's not human speech, it's not normative language, and I make the argument that it's our sound, it's our voice, because we're unhappy at the death of the character, and that we too are contributing to this sound, which is articulated through a character. So there's an empirical explanation for the source of the sound. But it's really coming from everyone, from all the readers of the book, and it just happens to be located temporarily, or for purposes of the fiction, aesthetically, in a source that we can identify.
It's like the commercial break for the voice.
Yeah, it's the commercial break.
I wanted to ask about that, the vocal displacement, because it's the second point in the essay, I think, when you make this jump between this is how sound is working in the text, and this might be a metaphor for how narrative works. The first point is on page 4 when you talk about narrative as a type of noise. It's about 5 lines from the bottom, and perhaps the invalid of St. Martin's Court may be a figure for the reader who, as he embarks on the task of making sense of a new text, must learn to listen as well as to see to make meaningful distinctions out of the random noise of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this critical move you make, like, this is the heartbeat, or this is the womb, or this is a human ear.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very powerful moments, and I think at these moments when you say, this might be how narrative is working in the novel, I just wanted to call attention to, and the second one was when you talk about vocal displacement, and you say that, like, a voice without a body is a metaphor for how the narrative works.
Mm-hmm.
What does that give us, what does this way of thinking about narrative give us that other ways of thinking about narrative don't? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about narrative as noise, thinking about it as a voice without a body or as a vocal displacement. Why are these generative ways of thinking about narrative?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to ask to you.
Good question. I'm not sure I've got an adequate answer,
mm-hmm.
but as a gesture toward that, I think that it's that literature is an interactive or relational medium,
mm-hmm.
and that it doesn't make sense until we process it. It's a version of the, you know, does the tree that falls in the forest when no one's around make a sound or not? It doesn't make a sound unless there's somebody there to listen. And the literary text doesn't make sense in whatever way you want to understand sense as sensation, physical embodied sensation, or rational intellectual sense, unless there's someone there to process it. And so what I was gesturing toward, I think, in those statements is that we need to learn how to listen to narrative, not just as performed orally, but as written, and elicit from it its oral qualities. And this is easier, perhaps more immediate in poetry,
mm-hmm.
Than it is in prose narrative, because we tend to think of the consumption of prose narrative as taking place in isolation and in silence. But we need to learn how to read audibly and restore that dimension to all literary texts,
mm-hmm.
not just to poetry that depends on rhyme and obvious assonance and alliteration and other techniques.
I like that idea.
Well, and I wonder also if maybe this concept of listening to literature is related to problem solving and detective work. In other words, I think of the 19th century novel as, you know, the era of Sherlock Holmes and even Dickens and other kind of problems, like Poe also, problem solvers where there's a mystery or there is cognitive appraisal that has to happen, right? You make a hypothesis about, oh, this is the relationship between these characters, or this is the source of the sound, or this is a mystery I have to solve. And it's guesswork in a lot of ways. And I guess what this piece on Old Curiosity Shop has reinforced for me is how much sound is a part of that detective work. In other words, you can't help but usually wonder, like, where the hell is this noise coming from, or what's going on here with this clash or this bang or this word that someone says. And it seems as if sonic experience tends to be very mysterious a lot of the time. If we don't recognize the sound, or if it's uncanny or fantastic, that we do guesswork as to what is the source of it, what is the provenance of it, and what is trying to be transmitted or communicated.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it is really performative too, though. Like, I just keep thinking about the operatic stage, mm-hmm. just because it's like where my brain always is. But or religious liturgy or something. So I think there's already that framework in place that it is fantasy. It depends on kind of maybe how the realism you're bringing to reading, or there's something there about the sociality of reading or the sociality of text or whatever. But I think there's this performative frame to kind of keep in mind that sort of conditions all instances of sound in the first place.
How do we think about the music of the spheres?
Well, it's kind of interesting, like, wait, I don't want to get off topic. I mean, I was sort of thinking about the music of the spheres as kind of similar to the machine that can record all sound and then somehow retrieve it, because I think, on one sense, it's, like, very metaphysical and very much placed in this, like, medieval Boethian mathematical tradition, but then it stays within, but then it also kind of points to, sorry, I lost my train of thought. Yeah, like, what would it really mean to hear the music of the spheres? Do you need to borrow a kind of sense organ from an intercession or a divine body, like an angel, perhaps, because they had this privileged position? Do you need to, like, kind of borrow that mechanism in order to hear a glimpse of the music, a version that can, like, you know, work within our aural organ to hear it? So it's both kind of, like, maybe quite highly accessible, but then at the same time, not. I don't know. There, yeah.
I wanted to
hark the herald angels sing, right?
Yeah.
And what is the medieval choir doing if not imitating in some way or trying to to reproduce that kind of heavenly music?
Yeah.
I wanted to share
actual printed music too that can reproduce.
Just thinking about the instances in which this needs to occur. I remember when you shared this essay with me a year ago, and I really got obsessed with the Babbage part because I was reading Dombey and Son at the same time, and I was talking with Stephen, the other member of the group, about it, and we went back and read the Ninth Bridgewater Treatise excerpts, and the context in which he brings it up, and this might be interesting to our question about testimony and witnessing yesterday, because when he introduces this idea of the atmosphere as a kind of recording device, it's in the context of talking about a slave ship that went down in the Atlantic, and like hundreds of slaves died. And he says that no one will be there to testify to their lives except for the air. The air will be there. And so, and he uses the words testimony. Like, the air will testify to their lives when the voices of those deceased can't. So it's somehow he's imagining. I tried to look up his politics, actually, as well, Babbage's, and it was hard to find. It was kind of like a kind of radical, like, point he was making, but I'm not sure what his status was in that regard. But what are the circumstances in which the air would testify? Like, why is he thinking of it from that? But it seems like he got the idea from a newspaper article that appeared and he read about it. Or at least that was the instance in which he decided to share this idea. And I thought that was interesting and maybe be useful to follow up with for people interested in testimony and witnessing.
I wonder, this kind of ties to the detective point. I know that there's a history in pottery of, like, a philosophical theory that sounds can be recorded into the pot as it's being spun on the wheel. It's outside of the realm of knowledge that I super know really well, but I know that I've heard someone give a talk on this, and so kind of the idea that the air will testify, the idea, again, of the materiality of sound, that sound might be able to be captured, especially by accident in some way. You know, there's, like, a famous vase that they say has, like, the cries of Jesus in it or something like that. Like, I'm not making it up.
It's a
historical thing. And then that kind of links me to Chip's comment about detective work. Oftentimes it's about voicing, especially of a victim who can no longer speak, and finding the material traces that would be able to show their existence or show their plight.
Really, confession as, like, a setting where they're, like, kind of made to use their voice either against them or to record down some kind of verdict or something.
Well, and that's a great connection I would make, because I have a chapter on detective novels, but what the ultimate conclusion is that Sherlock Holmes almost always has to, like, meet the criminal and get a confession at the end. Like, so in so many of the novels especially, it's like, all right, we got him sitting down, and now we're going to get his story. And it's like this subversion of the detective novel, because the idea is that Sherlock Holmes is going to figure it out for us, but then the voice of the actor himself of these atrocities will often have to verify that the solution that was found is indeed correct and explain the situation. So there's something kind of paradoxical, and certainly in what you're saying related to confession and a kind of larger religious instance of, you know, like confessing the wrong that you've done. That's very interesting.
I really recommend the book by Stephen Connor on ventriloquism. Because ventriloquism is all about a sound that comes from somewhere other than what you think it should be coming from. And ventriloquism means speaking from the stomach, or the stomach, the stomach speaks. So, I mean, the, you know, our familiarity with ventriloquism is the guy with the dummy and his lips don't move. But when Connor traces the cultural history of ventriloquism, he goes back to the oracles, the Greek oracles, and that's where the god is speaking through the medium, and all sorts of spiritualism and table knocking and all that whole phenomenon is part of what he studies under the concept of ventriloquism. And so I think ventriloquism is all about, it's mixed up in this notion of uncanny sound, of the displaced voice. And it's about voices.
So I think there's something there about the any sound that's produced has a performer. And so the disturbance in some ways is the ambiguity or uncertainty around who is the prime mover in some ways, the performer of the sound. So even with the wind chimes example, we might be able to resolve ourselves to say, oh, well, you know, the wind is knocking this human-made object. It's a human-made object that uses natural phenomena to produce a sound. But what continues to make it somewhat magical, quite literally, is that ambiguity of who is performing the sound. You know, is the wind an agent? And so then again, like in all these instances, there's this question of where does agency lie in production of this sound, and the disturbing possibility that it could be something supernatural, or something, or even not something supernatural, but something supernatural, something that does not fit within the logics of and paradigms of what we think to be, you know, how the world is constituted, and that's how I think the voice manages still to be uncanny, is because there is this breaking of the logic and a questioning of what agent is it that made this possible, and that's why you have to resolve it in God or in art, you know, or in genius, which again is an inspirited form of human. Right.
It's interesting. I think maybe for us too, there's been a lot of conditioning from like the voice in cinema. Like the way it's kind of played with diegetically, non-diegetically, that probably is quite similar to like novels, and so that idea of like an authoritative voice, like literally booming over the image, and a lot of that has been talked about from like a psychoanalytic standpoint. So I think maybe there's been, and this is something maybe some people, at least in musicology, kind of try to unwork a little bit, like Nina, like kind of like unburdening a lot of that anxiety, because maybe it has been a little, there has been a lot of anxious meanings kind of tied to the voice, the voice of the mother in the womb and all this, that maybe, I don't know, for whatever reason, what you just said just kind of made me think of that. So there is, trying to just play like devil's advocate a little bit, that it doesn't necessarily have to be anxious all the time. It can be uncanny and maybe not anxious written at the same time. I don't know.
I think so too, because the thing I keep trying to think with a disembodied voice is like a Victorian seance, right? Like a lot of, and this idea of ventriloquism, like I think that there's, I don't know, historically we could say just like sort of trickery involved in that kind of experience, but in terms of being both a theatrical performance, but also something that people would attend and want to see and like want to be hearing from a deceased relative or what have you, like, and then a person with an ability to throw their voice or create a visual illusion that the voice was elsewhere, mm-hmm. or a complicated series of knocks that were going to come from a table somewhere. Mm-hmm. That is that notion of the source of the sound is disembodied, the source of the sound is unknown, but also, depending on the audience member, I suppose, the experience of that would be any number of things. You know, it'd be the greatest experience of your life, or you'd be like, "God, this is foolery," you know.
Maybe it goes back then to Freud, and because my question around why, whether how much you how much fidelity you feel to Freud is this question of the repressed, right? Because as I understood it, the uncanny is the resurfacing of that which has been repressed, and there can be you know, there's the death drive, there's also the pleasure principle. So there is also like a you know, when I think about the circumstances of the industrial transition, you know, those moments of metaphysics and supernatural taking place, they're disturbing because we've repressed God, or we've repressed you know, we've repressed the supernatural in the embrace of the empirical and the mechanical. And I think, to go directly to your text, when you talk about Humphrey's mansion, you know, there you talk about it as you know, where a warehouse where sounds from the past still linger, awaiting activation by the presence of an attentive listener, you know, whose motion triggers the ghostly playback mechanism. Like, I think I keep on feeling like those moments of uncanny sound are the sound of something that is waiting to, that has been repressed, but through being ignored or through being literally, you know, repressed in some way, that are waiting to come back into the world by some means.
Well, that comment makes me want to raise the question of the historicity. What it is, what is being repressed, and that's resurfacing. Something that is individual, mm-hmm. In the individual consciousness or unconscious, mm-hmm. or is it something which is historically or culturally repressed that's more general and perhaps political? I mean, you raised the political issue, so...
I mean, in the case of the slave ship, it's historical and political, right?
It's historical and
but political. Also spiritual and ethical. I mean, there's these dimensions to it, overlaying.
I was curious what you thought of the Chip's detective comment, because I think that, because I remember taking your class and we read about detective fiction as even a metaphor for narrative, like trying to find the end, the exclusion. You brought up confession. Mm-hmm. I think thinking of narrative, a noise as a metaphor for narrative, or vocal displacement, voice without a body, voice in a different body, different bodies as metaphors for narrative, is different than the detective. I think it's helpful to think of it that way, but I think it's different because it resists the closure or the drive for closure that I think the detectives, the forensic, sonic forensics of the detective model or the confessional model. Like, I'm thinking again of a voice presentation yesterday where they had the circle and they're like, you start out as this person and then you have a shock, and then you go back and you're new, but you're actually just a new version of the same thing. It was very Foucauldian, and it was very like, and I read about a lot of Foucault in confession this past semester, and who was like, you have a silent, you know, confessor asking the penitent, really just for, they're going to say what you want them to say. Whereas I think thinking of narrative as noise and allowing for the ambiguity we've talked about or the uncanniness provides a different... a generative metaphor for thinking about narrative, really, than the detective or the confessional model.
Well, for me, the detective tradition wants to find answers, wants to find solutions to mystery. So it obeys the Foucauldian circle that you just described. Rather, but what we could perhaps in a very general sense called postmodern detective fiction, leaves the mystery unsolved. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a if you will, a deconstruction of the empirical that leaves things hanging, that leaves things in suspense and doesn't attempt to close the circle. So in terms of the face opera experience that you described, there is a recuperation. The confession is what is has been sought. The solution is always there from the beginning. But the moment, the real uncanny moment is that moment of shock that perhaps can't be fully recuperated, that where racial identity is a mystery, where signifier and signified don't line up, and the discomfort that we have, maybe not anxiety, but discomfort is in that discrepancy between the two.
Has anyone read The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, this Agatha Christie novel? It was recommended to me this summer because it's one of the, if you saw the, the Midnight Express, what was the?
Murder on the Orient
Express. It's a Poirot, but it's a, I was told to read it because there's a narrative trick in it, and then also because there's a phonograph in it, and it's like the first one to have that. I don't want to give away the ending. Should I give away the ending?
Don't give away.
Yeah, it's really good. It's short too, if you want it. But it is this. It does have this. It is a whodunit, right? But the whodunit comes about in a way that has to do with sound that I think you should check out. It's really cool, and it's an easy read.
one other point in relation to narrative that I think is briefly touched on in my paper is that. Narrative omniscience has traditionally been modeled using the Foucauldian metaphor of the panopticon, that it's visual, that the omniscient narrator is like the guardian in the Jeremy Bentham panopticon who can see everything. But what happens if you transpose that to a sonic environment? That the narrator, the omniscient narrator in a narrative, is someone who can overhear everything, who hears the world, and that the people inside the world can hear only partially, and that the characters in detective fiction, that perhaps the narrator in a detective novel is the one who can hear the voices that the characters in the story can't hear.
I was just thinking about another film analogy, sorry. Like there's this idea, it's probably Xi'an, it's like the idea of symbolic sound that they would use sometimes for, because of coding issues in early film, like they couldn't kiss, or they couldn't be a male and female, they couldn't be, you know, affectionate on film or kiss anyway. So they, a light might flicker, there'd be thunder to kind of like, it is both what it is, but it's also pointing to so much more. Sometimes like maybe God or like these huge like cultural like systems that we have in place. And yet it's also just the flicker of a light bulb at the same time. Or it replaces that, like, which wasn't allowed to be seen at the time. And like, I don't know if that's like uncanny, but there's something there too, like kind of bringing two things together, as you sort of talked about with the
metaphor. Literally means a carrying over. It's a crossing of a boundary, and I think that all of these boundary crossings that we've been talking about and labeling uncanny are rooted in metaphor of some sort.
Yeah, it's good that I didn't. I was going to suggest or ask if you were familiar with Xi'an because.
Yeah.
Because that's as far
I know
as
there's
I know.
Other, he has a tech. He has so many taxonomies. Mm-hmm. But I just remember.
But
acousmatic
is I believe his word that he introduced.
It's Pierre Schaeffer.
Is it Pierre Schaeffer that he borrows?
But acousmatic sound goes back to Pythagoras too.
Okay.
Because Pythagoras, he was like one of these oracles that you're talking about, right?
Right.
That he
would hide behind the.
Yeah, it was like a sect of like Pythagorean like people who like. I guess that was like the highest honor was to be able to listen to Pythagoras without seeing him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, acousmatics. Then Pierre Schaeffer used it for his like idea of a cosmetic sound, and then Xi'an sort of like lifted it wholesale with a footnote. I mean, like, this is Pierre Schaeffer's thing.
Do you have a reference to write down for Xi'an?
Audio Vision, I think, is his.
I think one of his books is just called The Voice in Cinema.
Yeah,
too.
The Voice in Cinema, like that's the one where that's like super psychoanalytic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's good to probably have one. Yeah.
What is the status of Murray Schafer's book and the concept of soundscape now in contemporary sound studies? Because I used it as sort of the foundational text of the field, but there have been a lot of critiques of it, and some of what I was saying earlier was a critique of the dualism that seems to me fundamental to it.
But I remember last time, what was the guy from Geography? I forgot his name.
Nicholas.
He was he had pointed us to some articles that were critiquing Pierre Schafer, R. Murray Schafer. But I still feel like the soundscape, I think, is still just a very useful thing that people use, even though there are a lot of critiques. I remember when Nicholas was talking about last time I read the article, it was sort of like the idea that the soundscape is too much like a visual metaphor, and sort of like a visual, like static sort of metaphor. Whereas these various critiques, one I'm thinking of too is by Tim Ingold called Against the Soundscape, that it doesn't really pay attention to the way in which sort of sound is always changing or something, you know, the way that it isn't a static thing, that it's sort of a dynamic thing. But I think that a lot of critiques of Murray Schafer are just kind of like based on his, you know, it's kind of more wacky sort of ecological ideas, right? Like, he is just very much opposed to modernity and very much has a sense of, like, right, the past unadulterated soundscape.
Yeah.
But I'm more convinced by those critiques than sort of these things that soundscape is too visually oriented, personally. But
we asked Feld this question. We asked Stephen Feld this question, and he gave, one was the Ari Kelman piece, which you referenced in the bibliography. He also mentioned someone named Stephen Heliorex. I might have it spelled wrong. I can email him about that. But they, another person who kind of looks against. Yeah, Nicholas's question was, isn't it too
visual? Yeah, I think.
But he said that soundscape, landscape usually is associated with colonialism and that kind of representation mode. But he thought soundscape got us a little further past that. And there was a reference to McLuhan as too, as well.
I think the easy answer is that there's some useful critiques of the soundscape, but I think most people studying sound wouldn't throw him out.
Mm-hmm.
I still find that book Tuning of the World incredibly useful.
Yeah.
But I approach it like any book that has been around for a good number of decades, where I don't expect it to address all of my needs or concerns. I go to it for what is rich within it and take liberally from the things that I think still are operative and useful.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundscape as a concept, I think, is, I think similar to landscape, I think it requires contextualization, which both means putting it in the historical context of how we orient ourselves towards nature as if we can step outside of it and observe it, and two, its colonial implications, especially being in America, in North America, where, you know, our relationship to land is significantly different ontologically than indigenous relationships to land.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that, just because I brought that up, I would also say, like, there's a few things I would critique, or maybe not critique, there's things that I would want to be clear about in even talking about uncanny sound and your typologies, which is, I think they're really operative for an Anglophone text, and I think that it would be really important to consider that non-human persons having voice, that voice that we could actually hear and engage in, would be considered uncanny for a lot of cultures. Ghosts speak very liberally in Asian cultures. In most indigenous cultures, non-human persons are capable of speech, including winds and including rivers and including animals. So, it's I think in the context of Dickens is wonderful as a set of typologies to take it into a larger framework of how we think about recorded sound or sound in general. Would require a whole lot of complicating in order to actually speak to other situated experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's 12:05, and we said we'd end at noon, so I want to be sensitive to your time, but if there's any last questions for John, we could hang out a little longer, or the plan is to get lunch till now. till 1, and then we were going to do some work on the conference for April, which would be good. But
do you have a time? Do you have to go, or do you have a minute or two?
I've got some more time.
Okay. Would you like to join us for lunch, or
where are you going to go?
Well, we should talk about that. I mean, there's because for one thing, there's food. I mean, there's fruit and leftover pizza and bagels. I mean, it depends on what people.
There's also salad. There's a lot of salad and sandwiches.
At
we don't know if we can get in there until 1, right?
I think it was 1. Yeah.
So one possibility is we could wrap up in this room, take some of these things outside, and picnic. And kind of keep going on conversation.
Should we say bye to Chip?
Chip.
I know, I don't want to lose you, Chip.
Go outside, have a picnic.
That's right, I want to live by Thursday from you all.
So yeah, I mean, one possibility is that we, rather than having a formal, like, let's take an hour, go into the village and get food and then meet back up in an hour, we could just kind of, we could just carry this over into the next building by way of the picnic. The other possibility is if people are like, I could really use a half hour to just go off and do a thing, we could just break off, fend for ourselves, and come back. So, I don't know. What
we could also just, we could see if the room's open. If it's not, we'll just go get sandwiches. Or, who, yeah.
I mean, it's right across. Like, I could walk over if you want. It's right there.
What do folks want to do? Maybe, it's just, do people want to stick around together for lunch? People feel like they need to stretch their legs?
Could take a break.
Okay. Well, maybe then before we take that break and before Chip says goodbye, you know, just any last questions or thoughts on this text and this conversation. Chip, you especially should have the mic for a minute because we're gonna have to unplug you at some point.
No, I'm just enjoying conversation right now. I have nothing more to add.
Okay. John, in your formal capacity as our visiting professor.
And the PI.
And the PI. Do you have anything you want to offer before we transition to just kicking around?
Nothing more that I feel a need to say about the text, except that I've enjoyed the conversation. I really enjoyed hearing the sort of summary of what you've been doing up until this point. That